Supercade.
It's Supercade, it's time for fun, and no one else can do it better. And it feels alright, because it's Supercade time. Let's have some Supercade fun. Yes, it's Supercade time. Let's have some Supercade fun, fun, fun.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Johnny Jungle Guts.
And I am Professor Extra.
And you're listening to Super Gay, a podcast where we talk about all things gay in comics and more.
But mostly comics.
So today on the show, we have the amazing Steve Orlando. But first, let's just check in with each other about where we are with the comics.
Well, I have been reading, like so many other people who are big fans of the X-Men, the two series, limited series, I think one just wrapped up, right? It's a 6-issue series called House of X and Powers of X by Jonathan Hickman, Pepe Larraz, R.B. Silva, and Marty Gracia on colors. And I have to tell you, Johnny, this is some great X-porn. The mutants are empowered. They're still a minority, but they're empowered. They have a pharmaceutical company that they are using to fund their new utopia on the island of Krakoa, which is a living island. And it kind of recasts the whole conversation as more of a conflict between kind of biological power and technological consciousness, and the potential of living into eternity. Have you been reading this?
Yes, I'm not completely up to date. I forget where I left off. I think I left off right before everyone died, but that's where I read up to. But I felt like that was just something was going to happen with the timeline or something, because that was so over the top, or who knows.
Well, okay, so X fans, this is an X spoiler. So I'm going to tell everybody who hasn't read this yet, go read House of X, and it's complete now. Before I tell you what happened. So actually, Johnny, the mutants have conquered death. The way they did this is that there are 5 mutants. I'm not going to tell you who they are because it's some deep cut excitement, but I'll tell you one of them. 5 of the mutants are called the 5, have learned on the island of Krakoa, where they now live in this utopian paradise, that if they work together, they can defeat death. And the key to this is gold balls.
Gold balls!
Oh, wow. I'm glad we're bringing gold balls back.
So the listeners might remember Gold Balls as our kind of hefty Latino mutant who is able to create these golden balls out of his body, and that was his superpower, right? And you said, you said that you had some issues with it because it was kind of a reference to his weight, and it was a kind of joke, right? Was that part of the issue with it a little bit?
I thought maybe the sphericalness of the ballness, and then we had a last bouncing boy we were talking about that day, right, too. So I thought the balls might have had something to do with his stature.
Right. Okay, so it turns out that gold balls are actually eggs. Oh. In which mutant bodies can be hosted.
Whoa.
And using the DNA of the mutants, they can resurrect dead mutants. So all of the mutants that die in that issue, where all the mutants die, are resurrected later, and in an incredible rebirthing ritual that requires 5 different mutants using their powers together in this kind of post-sexual rebirth scenario. And then Storm, of course, leads all of them through this ritual of re-entrance into the mutant culture in this kind of like campaign rally, pro-mutant like insanity that caused a lot of consternation on Twitter amongst the people who were worried that the X-Men were becoming an evil cult or something. But a lot of us who see that more as a kind of minoritarian self-made subculture were really into it. And at the end of that issue, actually, they also start a amnesty program for mutant villains.
Sure.
So all the mutant villains get to move to Krakoa. And I got to tell you, you know, this has been something that comes up in the Steve Orlando interview a little bit. We talk about villains. I have been feeling a little ambivalent, to say the least, and maybe getting pretty critical of the notion of the villain. Because so often the villain is a way of kind of othering and even kind of projecting the negative onto some other figure. When one of the things I love about X-Men is that you get to know the villain, you understand that their motivations most of the time actually make some kind of sense. And on the other hand, you know, we do have this problem right now politically with our own president who acts like a villain, right?
Sure.
Like a bad guy. So I've been really, really wrestling with this idea because I guess the thing is villains are often, you know, they're often like kind of queer coded. They're often othered physically, disabled, or look different, and even intellectual off a lot of the time, right? The evil scientist, etc. So what I love about what they did here is they brought all the villains in and said, listen, if you guys follow a couple rules, we can actually put all those past issues aside and start over again. And so I think this has been great, and that's what I've been reading. So I started to go on for so long, but it's been really fun. There are also some really deep cuts, you know, Doug Ramsey is back, and he's also one of the main characters who, you know, because he can speak any language, he can speak to Krakoa, and he becomes a central figure. So I like what they're doing with the characters who seem to have powers that don't seem useful are becoming the central kind of hubs of the machinery of this whole narrative.
I think Jonathan Hickman has a style of writing where sometimes it seems like everyone sort of sounds like Reed Richards. I know he wrote Fantastic Four for a while, but everyone has this sort of intellectual cadence to their voice. I will say, though, that I just, you know, reading it, it really feels like he's doing, like, I don't know how to put it, but almost like big X-Men writing. Like, you know that this storyline is going to reverberate through countless media adaptations and through sort of the histories of time. We're going to get storylines that call back to this storyline in the future. You know, he's actually doing something that is going to make an impression on the sort of canon of X-Men is what I immediately picked up. It also reminded me a lot of like really, really lore heavy, like tabletop RPGs when you get into the futuristic side of it, like almost like Warhammer or something like that, where we're in the future and it's like almost like a high fantasy meets science fiction type moment that we're getting, which of course I love. I've really liked it so far. Yeah,
me too. It's just been fun and different, and the characters who are there are great, and we'll see what happens with it in the future. It's going to launch a bunch of new X books, and of course there'll be good and bad and all of that, but it's I'm glad to see that a new kind of imagining is happening, and it's not one that's all about how as a minority you have to always be killed and die. You can actually come back. It also gives a good explanation for the fact that we know that all the characters will inevitably come back anyway, so now it's just through gold balls as his eggs.
Gold balls!
So what have you been reading?
Well, I've been keeping my nose in the tabloids where Martin Scorsese announced that Marvel films are not cinema.
Oh, yeah, and I agree with that.
Then James Gunn responded in defense. And then, of course, we have the whole controversies going on right now with the Joker. Is the Joker movie encouraging violence? Is it encouraging shootings? There's police at the movie theaters. And everything, all these different things are going on. The, you know, Joaquin Phoenix and the director of the film are doing a terrible job of talking about this movie they've just made, which I haven't seen either, and really probably have no interest in seeing. But the whole spectrum of it, I think what it kind of boils down to for me a little bit is we've all sort of stopped recognizing something about the superhero genre, which is that, and people are going to get really mad at me for saying this, but which is that it's innately stupid and it's supposed to be fun. It is a comic book genre it's not ever going to, you know, we can pick it apart critically, but you can never take it too seriously, I don't think it's ever worth it for that. And that's where we end up with these movies where the Joker isn't, you know, when I think about the Joker, I think about Mark Hamill. I think about Cesar Romero, who had a lot of fun with the character, who, you know, it was sort of, especially with Cesar Romero, it was a very sort of Dada thing. I remember, like, the Joker throwing red herrings at Batman, like physical herrings from a crane once. That was a beautiful visual to me. And also when you're talking about queer-coded characters, of course you can't leave the Joker out of that. My take on villains a lot of the times is that the plot is sort of setting them up to be more, interesting or likable than the hero, even.
Mm-hmm.
I think even the Heath Ledger Joker performance is kind of like a perfect example of that. And obviously, yes, there's a lot of murder and mayhem that goes along with that, but it's sort of not... That was sort of in a time where you wouldn't expect that people would take all of this so seriously. That's the whole thing, right? That's, I guess, what that Joker said. Why so serious? And that's kind of the problem with both the movie and both the people who are arguing in defense of James Gunn, or in defense of superhero cinema. Like, that isn't the most mainstream thing. You don't need to defend these movies. They're the most successful things in the world. And so I just feel like we all just need to remember that this was a genre created for children. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to pick apart critically. But at the end of the day, we just have to chill out and just have fun with it and not turn it into like a religion. And that's kind of where I feel like we're starting to go a little wrong here.
But Johnny, it is a religion.
For some people, it is. But I feel like I got into it so I could
get
out of religion.
It's taken the place of religion. But it takes the same place. I mean, I was showing some friends my action figures on my shelf in my bedroom, and it was reminding me a lot of the altars that my grandmother had around her house, where she has all these little Virgin Marys everywhere.
Of course,
And, you know, I have all these multiple Storm action figures, and I'm talking about, well, this one kind of represents this. I mean, I don't know. I think I hear what you're saying, absolutely. I think the key issue here is that neither you nor I have seen the film, nor have many of the people who have particular positions on it, but that the language around it has been questionable. And there is the history of the Aurora shooting, which I think is relevant to the discussion here, as well as the rash of mass shootings across the country. And when you think about the ways in which nerd and geek culture overlap with some of the uncomfortable, you know, negative trends in the political sphere, I think that there is something to say to really critiquing it. It's also that it seems irresponsible the way that they have been talking about it. But then that said, it's like it's all promotion for this film that's projected to earn what, $75 million in this weekend that we're talking right now. So I don't know. I think it's complicated and we have to unpack it. But at the same time, I don't care very much. So then I'm kind of like, because, you know, I'm not a big Batman person. So I'm kind of like, oh, wow, a lot of ink is being spilled on this. A really smart marketing strategy on the part of it's Warner Brothers, right? The film seem like a dangerous and edgy thing, when all the reviews I've read of it are like, this isn't that interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty much what the consensus I've gotten as well. So, I mean, I just think everyone, and yeah, of course we need to talk about the school shooting environment, but I think that partially comes out of people taking this media too seriously, right? You know, thinking that the Joker is some kind of hero to them, or that someone that they should imitate, when it's like a cartoon character for children.
But that's kind of what we do with these characters. We act them out on the playground, you know.
That's true.
So I don't know. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I also want to say I don't think it's really the problem of thinking too critically. I think if anything, it's actually not thinking critically.
Oh, no. Critically is good. Critically is very good. I'm talking about seriously, taking everything so seriously.
Yeah, I hear you, Johnny Jungle Guts. all right. Well, actually, one more question then. What did you make of this idea that the superhero movies, particularly the Marvel movies, are not cinema? Because I actually thought there was some point to that, and I've been saying that for a while. It doesn't actually, to me, invalidate them. What we have to understand is they're kind of a new form, because they're a lot more like television in terms of structure, because they're so episodic and completely interrelated. The other thing is that I think technologically, they actually have much more in common with video games than they do with like traditional cinema. So I don't know. I mean, I hear what he's saying. I just don't think this is one where I think the idea that cinema is the only type of art that can exist within the sort of moving image form is where I would push back on Scorsese.
Yeah.
But But that said, I think, like, guys, if you think you're making cinema, and this is part of the problem with the Joker, is
exactly.
It's acting like cinema, and it should just calm down.
Right, exactly. That's exactly. I mean, I don't disagree with Scorsese, and I think that's a fine opinion to have. It doesn't mean I'm not going to still, you know, get into this material. But I totally see what you're saying. That's a pretty succinct way of looking at it.
Super K.
Let's get into it. So you and I've had the opportunity to talk to a real life professional working queer comic book writer, Steve Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into our interview with Steve.
Great.
Okay, so this is Super Gay, and today we're joined by our very special guest, Steve Orlando. Steve Orlando is a writer for DC Comics. He's known for his work on Martian Manhunter, Wonder Woman, Midnighter, and the Justice League of America. He lives in Boston and identifies as bisexual and half Jewish. Welcome to the show, Steve.
It's good to be here. Thank you, man.
When did you first get interested in comics?
Very early. You know, I was actually just at a convention in Ohio and I ran into Steve Englehart, who wrote the first comic I ever bought, actually, which was in 1987. And it was West Coast Avengers number 16, A Tale of Two Kitties, which was about Tigra and Hellcat fighting over what at the time was just called the cat costume, which was the Hellcat costume. And they eventually get over their feud and fight Tiger Shark and win, and it was all very good. But that was the first book that I bought, and that was, you know, I was like 2 years old. So I mostly was just looking at the pictures back then.
Two? You were 2 years old?
In 1987, yes.
Wow. I'm salivating over that storyline, by the way. It's too good.
It's a great cover as well. But anyway, I always thought I was going to be an artist, but as time progressed, I realized through reading like the bullpen bulletins and editorial notes and things that I really wanted to be a writer, combined with the fact that my art is not something that people would pay money for. I did write and illustrate a book in college, like a 100-page book, so I know what it is to do every part of making a comic, and that was kind of the reason I did it. But I then swiftly destroyed all but like 10 copies of that because it can never be released into the public. No one can see what my visual art looks like. But but it was like, you know, like 92 came around. So you flash forward and I'm 7 and the Clone Saga is happening. And I was actually buying books off Spinner Racks and Walden Books at that time because there was no comic store in my town yet. But they were there. And so I got Clone Saga and I it all seemed normal to me. This is why my writing has taken a turn often, because the times I got in were like West Coast Avengers and then the Clone Saga and then later Electric Superman. So the concept of what is deep cut and what is like major fandom is always very strange to me.
Right.
So when I bought Spider-Man, the Jackal was just like quoting Leave It to Beaver for no reason and just cloning everywhere. So I got into that, but again, like I didn't really see it as a career path. And then in 97, I bought all the Electric Superman stuff because there was an article in the Syracuse New Times about how he was never going back to red, blue, and yellow Superman. And I was like, fuck, I have to get on board with this. It's never changing. And and so I bought that. And there was an article in the newspaper about how the character evolved and was created, redesigned, I should say. And the writing input on that really showed me that that's where I wanted to land. And that was when I was 12, and that's when I started going to comic conventions and trying to break in. So, you know, there's 12 years of making bad comics and finding out how to get better. Not 12, excuse me, more than that. From age 12 to 28, making bad comics and finding out how to make them better and making them professional quality. And it did happen, finally, after a long time. But that is how I got there. It's all the, well, for many people were off roads in comics, like Clone Saga. Those are my on ramp. So I think it explains a lot about my work when you see what I bring back to certain books.
So as a gay comics podcast, we often talk about adolescence as a time when we were interested both in comics and first became kind of interested in boys. We're wondering, like, when did you come out as bi, and were superheroes involved in any way?
Well, you know, the book I started at DC on Midnighter was very formative to me when he debuted as a character, because at that time, at least in my opinion, representation had sort of changed from what we have now. What you got in mainstream media was a very certain type of queer or gay person, which was totally valid, but I didn't see myself in that person. The sort of peppy, energetic type.
Jack.
Yes, and I'm a dour cynic from Central New York, so I was just like, that's not me. And I like blowing shit up, so I was just like, okay. But then Midnighter came along, and I was like, here's this guy that is, like, you know, edgy and just the sarcastic in me, and is both hard and soft, for lack of a better phrase, right? Like, he's hard on the outside, but he has these very real feelings for Apollo. And that was very formative to me, because at that time it was like, oh, like, there's no one way to be queer. There's no one way to be gay. And that was kind of the first time I saw that. Flip the script now, and I think that we've almost overcompensated. And, you know, now it's important, I think, to say that there's nothing wrong with being a Just Jack type of person, you know, with, you know, a lot of, oh, you know, I'm gay, but not that gay type of representation and, like, whatever. But I think it's changed in 20 years. But anyway, that's where I sort of got in. I mean, you know, when I was reading comics in the 80s, North Star was definitely not gay, but was certainly half fairy. So, like, things come a long way.
Right.
And because that was canon. And it was still, I mean, that was, let's see, Authority came out in 1999. So I was 14. I didn't come out till I was 21, but, you know, I definitely knew what was going on when I was 14. For me, I didn't, and again, I don't say this to intend, like, you know, coming out is a journey, and sexuality is an evolution, and it in of itself is a journey. So when I say the following, I respect anyone's journey, but for me, I did not want to be one of the people that had basically used saying that you were bi as sort of the stepping stone to coming out, well, I'm actually just gay. And, you know, I understand that I understand the pressures and all the reasons people do that. So I don't want to denigrate that. But I wanted to know, at least in my own life, if, you know, if my interest in women was a phase or not, or if it was phasing out. And when it finally didn't, you know, and I was actually dating a girl who was bi at the time, I was like, okay, now is the time. You know, like, it's definitely not going anywhere. And you know, like, sexuality continues to evolve. Mine has evolved since then. I still identify that way. So I waited a little longer, you know, than some other people, even within my class in high school and college. For me, I wanted to know that when I finally did it, it was going to be the way it was. And so I personally took a little longer than some other people, perhaps.
Did your identification as bi have any kind of impact on your experience breaking into the industry? You know, did you kind of come out professionally at some point?
When I came out at 21, people had already known me for 9 years, you know, in the comics industry. So there was already the person-to-person connection with almost everyone in power in comics that often can smooth over the sort of tension and anxiety of coming out, you know? And so I admit, like, I honestly did not struggle the way that other people, some folks have. And largely, you know, with the publishers I've worked at, the reception has been very welcoming. But, you know, yes, of course, you had to, much like anything else, these are people that had become friends and peers, and so they certainly found out, and they found out well before I broke at DC, you know, because 21 to 28 is 7 more years of trying to break in.
Yeah, but you, like, sort of started some of these relationships almost, like, as just, like, a kid, like, when you were real young, almost, like, as a fan or something like that.
Well, as a kid, but not as a fan. Like, I legitimately was showing up to
convention. Oh, you were trying to, yeah, you were trying to get in there. Okay.
So, yeah, cool. I mean, I had scripts and expected to be hired when I was 12. I was, of course,
That's awesome.
Cool, but that was the reality. You know, I pitched DC a Nightmaster book with Tom Lyle when I was 14 years old.
Wow. Well, who's Nightmaster? I don't know Nightmaster.
Well, he's dead now. Poor guy. He died in metal. Nightmaster is basically like a glam rocker who finds out that all this stuff that glam rockers sing about was real, and he gets connected to this magic world of Mira, and he gets this sword of night that can talk to him and all these things, and he's basically like rock and roll He-Man.
All right. and, check him out. So even breaking into the comics industry, it's kind of really intense work, you know. I mean, maybe less for a writer than an artist, but do you feel like any of your like relationships have been kind of ruined by the fact that you're a comic book writer?
With other people in comics, or with shall we say lay people?
Lay people. Let's go with the lay people.
I mean, my boyfriend right now is a classical musician who's really into drum corps and Star Trek, so we're kind of working on the level. but it's if the real answer, and perhaps the more like sobering answer, is that if it did affect my relationships, it's the people that told me to give up. You know? Which there are many, because there are less, you know, working at DC Comics, it's easier to get a job in the New York Yankees. There are more spots on that team than there are writing for DC Comics. So, you know, like that panel in Wanted, the quite bad comic by Mark Miller. you know, and every day, the guy who's definitely not Eminem, Wesley, walks down the steps, and this old codger is like, cheer up, kid, maybe it just won't ever happen. Like, you know, that was like 50% of people in my life were like that dude. And to be fair, I also wanted to smack them in the mouth when they said that to me, like he does. But yeah, it affected you in that way, because you see how people really like either themselves have given up and don't understand what it is to sort of keep fighting for something, or they really don't believe in you. And in that respect, it definitely has affected relationships. And then the advent of nerd culture in the mainstream in the reverse has definitely affected my relationships in ways I never would have expected. You know, like guys who were putting me in lockers in high school, I came back from my 10-year reunion and they're like, oh, do you know about Slade? Do you know about Deathstroke? I'm like, yeah, bro. I fucking know about Deathstroke. I like, and I knew about him 10 years ago too, when you were kicking me in the balls and shit, but like, that's fine.
So let's focus a little bit then on the characters that you've written and the personalities that you've shaped. So Midnighter and Apollo have been very important gay characters who were really not created by gay artists and writers. And your two runs with Midnighter were early subjects for us on the podcast, and we really, really enjoyed them. Can you tell us what, from your point of view, makes Midnighter a unique character who is able to carry his own series from time to time?
Well, you know, when I took him on, the character sort of, you know, the less well known a character is, the less rules there are, you know, like, which is like, maybe comes as a surprise, maybe doesn't, but you know, you can do things in Midnighter that you can't do in Batman. Although I couldn't show Midnighter's dick, so there you go. To me, he became a character about growth. You know, the first year, the first solo series that Garth did, which I did think had some really amazing moments, especially if you look at it through an action lens. It had some other stuff that wasn't great, but it did have Midnighter going back in time and kicking Hitler in the balls, which is something I wish that I did. But if that book was about how all he is this fighting machine... And it is, you know, it's literally, I mean, it opens with him just spinning a map and putting his finger down and going there to punch someone in the face. This next book had to be about growth, you know, and so the way I write him is he is a macro narrative of what we all go through when we try to find a balance with the crazy shit that has happened in our lives. And of course, with Midnighter, it's not that he can sometimes, you know, I mean, it's not... It's all in the grandest comic book style, you know. Obviously, we are all not people trying to balance the fact that we have uncontrollable homicidal tendencies, and we're just trying to, you know, turn that frown upside down. And that also that we haven't been abducted and had our bones taken out and have carbon fiber put in. But the moral of that book is that it is accepting what happened to you, the good and the bad, and finding a way to find joy in your life. And I think people saw that in there, and it was really pleasing to me because it's not a character you would expect it from. But it is when you think about him. What I always knew about Midnighter is that he always knows 100% who he is in every situation. It's one of the reasons I undid that he had a, quote, like, secret identity when we started the book. It's like there's no secret ID, real ID. There's no, like, is Clark Kent the real guy or is it Superman? Like, he is 100% who he is in every scenario. And I think that there's pride and there's power in that. And that's if he's buying a fucking bagel or if he's, like, punching someone's eyeball out. You know, he is the same person in all those scenarios. And I think that the lack of willingness to compromise is really something special.
How did you get involved in writing Midnighter?
It was a bucket list character for me, but the specific opportunity came up. I spent years networking, and so when 2014 came around, I did a book called Undertow at Image, and a large part about getting your foot in the door in major companies is paradoxically getting your foot in the door somewhere else so that you can be published and show that you can create professional work and complete it, because anybody can do a 10-page pitch, but it's like, oh, you actually brought a book through to fruition. And so I got that book in Undertow around that summer, and it was just in time that a friend of mine who was formerly an assistant editor had been promoted to Batman editor. And, you know, a lot of comics in the entertainment industry is waiting for the stars to align. Well, in 2014, they aligned. Mark Doyle, who I'd known, gave me my first work at DC years ago in an 8-page story in Mystery in Space, was now the Batman editor. He had just done the big redesign of Batgirl that was super, super well received. And it finally, after, you know, this is when I was 28. So after like 16 years, gave him a chance, combining his own career as an editor and mine finally getting published, to say, Steve, what would you want to do if you could pitch DC? And I knew that the DCYOU initiative was coming, and I said, well, you know, you sort of revamped a prominent female character. You know, if you're going to revamp a prominent gay character, like, I'm right here, you know, like, I'm your man. And that's really how it came around. I knew Tom King and Tim Seeley, who had been working with Midnighter on In Grayson. You know, Midnighter recognizing Grayson by his ass is another scene I wish that I wrote myself. Mm-hmm. I will knock out the last one. There's only three scenes that someone else wrote with Midnighter that I wish were mine. And there's the ball, there's the Hitler balls. there's the scene I just said, I'd know that ass anywhere. And then I admit, fucking Garth Ennis, there's a scene in the first Midnighter series where he's like, you know, fighting some piece of shit villain, and the guy goes to give Midnighter the finger, but his fucking middle finger is half torn off. And so there's no dialogue. He gives Midnighter the half middle finger, and Midnighter's line after is, you're going to have to speak up, which is fucking incredible. And so those are my three scenes where I'm like, oh my God, if I could go back in time, if I had that DeLorean, I would definitely not do anything really good. I would just write those three scenes. But anyway, that's how it came together. You know, you get these moments. A lot of things in comics and in fiction in general, like, you know, you spend 2 decades waiting and then things happen in 5 seconds. And by the way, Midnighter was a 4-month development process, so it didn't happen in 5 seconds, but feels like it when you've been waiting, when you've been trying to break into comics longer than you haven't, you know?
Right. I mean, that brings up something that I guess you've touched on a little bit earlier, but I kind of wanted to ask you about this. I mean, masculinity and violence are kind of hallmarks of characters like, I don't know, Batman, Punisher, Lobo, who you've written. What does it mean to you to make an ultra-violent kind of hyper-mask? I don't even know if he's hyper-mask, but he's very mask. A character like Midnighter also be a gay character?
Well, I mean, similar to what I had said earlier, you know, it's, at the time, I think it was quite significant because you had only seen a relatively feminine representation of a gay man in mainstream media. Or just dangerous representations and things like Cruising, you know, like, gay men will hunt you down and murder you. Okay,
right.
cool, man. But and so at the time, I think that it was groundbreaking because it said that you can be all these things and you can also be gay. But I do think, as you were probably kind of hinting at, that the 20 years that intervened, the message had to kind of evolve. And that's why I wanted to make him more than just this sort of like masculine pastiche. He's still willing to be soft around people. He's willing to show vulnerability. I mean, he shows incredible vulnerability with Apollo. And I guess what we're really saying in that way is that, you know, being masculine, quote unquote, doesn't really mean what you thought it meant. You know, it's not emasculine to be vulnerable. It's, you know, or realistically, these words don't mean anything. It's a construct. So, you know, I think we had to do more, and we had to make him more than just like violent bro dude who happens to fuck dudes. Like, it had to be a message, and that's why we're it is about him landing on his feet and finding his life and finding his own pride within himself, because it's like anything else, like the character's 20 years old, every other character has to evolve. He had to evolve to serve the community that he once served in a different way when he debuted.
Right
Now, you touched on Apollo really briefly there. How is writing Apollo different than writing Midnighter? And also, do you prefer Apollo with short or long hair?
There are a lot of opinions about Apollo and short and long hair. and I don't... So the real answer is I don't have a preference. I had to write him with the hair that he had. You know, I did not have a lot of cultural cachet at the company when I started, and I was not going to be like, well, this design is garbage, you know. So, but I do think that there are a lot of arguments that there is something more subversive to him having long, you know. There's plenty of essays about how his long hair makes him more of a feminine icon, and again, on one hand, I respect that. I push back against labels like that for myself. So I sort of like, I'm excited that people find that in him and find a softness and a caring in him that is, you know, subversive at times. I try to stay away from a lot of assumptions like that myself. So I don't personally have a preference, but the real answer is that like, these characters are a lens for your own views. And if you find empowerment in him having long hair, then I think that's wonderful. And if you find empowerment in him having short hair and being the more traditionally, between the two, slightly more traditionally feminine of the two, while being the one that we usually show topping, you know, because I like to subvert expectations, then that's great too. You know, like, especially with characters that I don't believe that in that authorial intent is the final word anyway in anything, but especially not in work for hire characters. Like there is baggage and experience with these characters that starts before us and is going to go long after us. So I'm excited for whatever people take from Apollo in the same way that I'm excited for whatever people take from Midnighter. Like I write him for the queer community when I'm on that book, but at the same time, I'm not unhappy when straight people come to my table and they're excited. Oh, I never thought I would enjoy a book with a gay character before. Well, it's not good that they had that assumption, but it's also good that they're willing to break it. And that's not equal, obviously, to writing for the queer community, but I'm happy when a character can build bridges as well.
I mean, for the record, the two hosts of this podcast are split on the Apollo hair length.
Now you're still
conundrum.
Love it for you. Sorry about that.
But I guess I wanted to kind of follow up on this, you know, just a little bit more about Midnighter and Apollo. I reread the Midnighter and Apollo series today in preparation for this. And, you know, it stands up for me in so many different ways. And I think a lot of things you were talking about in relation to sort of humanizing or developing Midnighter further happens in that book. But what is it that you see is the root of their attraction? Because I think as they were first introduced, they were kind of analogs for Superman and Batman. So it was almost, I mean, I'm not saying that it was exactly a joke, but there was a kind of joke in their coupling. What attracts them to each other in your writing?
Well, it was a satire for sure. But so much of Wildstorm at that time was, but as often can happen, satire became powerful, and I think that I honestly really love the way Warren wrote them.
Yeah,
different opinions on creators that follow, but I love the way Warren wrote them. So to answer your question, I mean, originally it was shared experience, right? So like originally when they joined the DC Universe, it was that they were the only survivors of this crew and this shared experience grew into something more as they lived on the road and kept trying to find justice in any way they can. In the current book, one of the current takes, because there's also a take that I have nothing to do with going on right now in the Wildstorm, and I think it's great. Right. So, and it's more similar to what Warren had originally done. Character-wise, obviously the Wildstorm is vastly different from what the Authority looked like before. I think that there is a need in both of them, like much like in real life, Apollo needs someone to never give up on, because his parents gave up on him, as we've seen at least in my version of his DP origin. And Midnighter needs someone, conversely, I think that he knows he's safe being vulnerable around. He knows he's someone who is strong enough that they can handle all how dangerous he feels he is. You know, like he's a character with low self-esteem in my book because he thinks that he doesn't deserve better because of things that were done to him. And so he needs someone that will allow him to be something other than just a clenched fist. And for good and bad, and Apollo likewise wants to make good on what he didn't get. You know, he's trying to put back into the world what he didn't have as a kid. And I think that brings them together. You know, he's someone who they will never give up on each other. That's what the whole series is about. You know, like he's Midnight going down to beat up the devil. I mean, Midnight and Apollo was originally the fourth arc of what would have been an ongoing Midnighter series, and I honestly didn't know what I would do after that, because what's a bigger story than him kicking the devil's ass to get Apollo back, you know? So
Hey Johnny, you had a question about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're fighting the devil, and the devil's a pretty harsh guy, but one thing I noticed during the run is he's not really like homophobic at all. Was that like a very conscious choice?
I mean, when I write hell, I mean, my advisor in college was a John Milton scholar.
So sure.
I don't want to say that I'm very sympathetic towards Lucifer or in this case, Neron, but I tend to think that, you know, in most versions, and there's an aspect to this because Neron isn't Lucifer, you know, he's the one that is feeling the judgment, you know? So I don't necessarily know that I think the devil would be specifically homophobic, because when at least Milton's Lucifer is rebelling essentially because of angels not having the rights that humans have.
Sure.
So the traditional good evil dichotomy, I try to make it a little more complicated, but that said, in the case of, Neron specifically, I wrote him sort of as this personification of hell, sort of like how Telos was a planet, but also a person, and convergence. And so, you know, there's a primal sort of chthonic nature to him that I don't think has the contemporary animus to me would have felt out of place with him versus the more traditional, drinking souls out of a goblet is what Neron does. Like he doesn't really mind what type of souls they are. So it wasn't like, I just think that, you know, honestly, in a world as it is, supposing that the Bible is not fiction, the judgment is coming from God, not the devil. And so I think that nothing would anger God more, if I'm thinking about the character dynamics of these two people, than to not be homophobic, because he's everything that God is not. You know, and I don't know how I got on this tangent here, but welcome to me thinking about Christian fan fiction. But anyway, as I think about it more, like that's, you know, every time, you know, I almost did a book that was basically going to be like Jack Kirby's Christianity, and it was going to have the Lucifer character was going to be the Thor type character. And there would be a moment where he sort of sat down with God and was kind of like, well, you know, like, I don't feel one way or another about humans. Like, it's just sort of transactional. Like, I just hate you, you know? Mm-hmm. because you're the son of a bitch. And so I, that's kind of how I've always viewed him. I guess when you labor under a Miltonian for 4 years,
right?
What other choice do you have?
Interesting. I mean, that makes me think about a lot of things, but I'm going to focus here. Your villains are very complicated. I read your whole JLA run. I appreciate the fact that they tend to have a rationale that actually makes some sense, even if the results are totally bizarre. So what is your thinking on writing villain characters?
Well, I think that you have two types of antagonists, or villains, and they're both frightening in different ways, but one is only a trick you can pull out so often, right? Like, so you have people that are just evil, and I think there is something, again, like Neron is just, he's an idea, like he doesn't necessarily have sympathy. Darkseid is just the god of evil, you know, there's no his motivation is that he's the very idea of the ills of society. And similarly, like a character of the Joker is not someone I find sympathetic. The point is that he does these things without motivation, and that's why he is completely unsympathetic in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas then you have, if we're just going to stick on iconic Batman villains, then you have a character like Two-Face, who's incredibly sympathetic. And I think they play on Batman and us by proxy in different ways. You know, a villain you can relate to is like that friend who you failed, especially Harvey. You know, I think he can always get Bruce's goat. I can't believe I just said get goat. He can take Bruce off guard in a way that many other people can't, because Bruce will never forgive himself for letting Two-Face happen, basically. And he knows that that sympathy allows him to emotionally manipulate Batman, which maybe makes him even more of a son of a bitch than the Joker in some ways. But conversely, the Joker is just, he just does things, and that's frightening because it can't be explained. Mm-hmm. But I think that the evil you know is sometimes more realistic and thus a little more frightening. I think that you have to have a point of view with villains, and honestly it makes us think about ourselves, you know, because like, mm-hmm. I guess I'm being subversive here, even saying that the Joker is not sympathetic. Like, if you identify with the Joker, you probably don't, but if you identify with the Joker, you might also be 37% of America.
Super K.
I mean, I mentioned your Justice League run a second ago, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about Xenos and the Ray, a male couple, you know, who kind of gradually grow together, but get a little less on-panel time talking about their relationship than, say, Killer Frost and Adam. And I was wondering, you know, about the considerations and challenges that come into play when you're writing a gay super couple for DC, you know, on a big title like the JLA.
It's a lame answer, but like that, we didn't treat them any differently than any of the other characters, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, like I've been lucky, like editorial was very supportive of the Ray and Xenos. We haven't necessarily seen stable, positive queer couples enough. From a writing standpoint, I mean, just like with the Sex Season and Midnighter, like DC has been very supportive, and there was nothing we couldn't do with the Ray and Xenos that we could have done with a straight couple, for example.
Let's move on to Wonder Woman. I'm wondering, like, the special kind of challenge you have as a writer to keep things interesting with a character who is, in so many ways, perfection. What is your approach to writing Wonder Woman?
I think that she is... I have to say that she's perfect. I think she is perfectly good, but she can make mistakes. Much like I mentioned with my Supergirl run, when you have a character that is relatively lacking in imperfections, which most of our Big Seven characters are, they become a lens for how we as readers, via our proxies, would react to someone like that. You know, are there people around Wonder Woman that acknowledge that about her and will take advantage of her? And then how does she deal with that person? You know, are there, and not even villains, maybe people in the supporting cast, you know, is she someone who needs to learn that, yes, like, some people do not want to be better, whether it's for her own emotional stability and mental health, or because, you know, the endless chances that she gives people end up putting more people in the crossfire. You know, we have her moving to Boston, which is funny because I live here, but it's actually because Bill Messner-Loebs had her living here in the 90s. One of the first, you know, the question becomes like, well, you're safe here, like, you're invulnerable, but how do we protect Boston from you? You know, like, look at your life. and so it's that you use these seeming lack of problems and definite lack of weaknesses as a pivot point for how the world would react to that. And I think that's how you get story out of her. And of course, you build antagonistic and hurt her in ways that aren't physical, which you'll see as well going through the book.
So speaking a little bit about the supporting cast on Wonder Woman, you created a new version of the character Aztec for your Justice League series and then brought her over to Wonder Woman. What made you want to reintroduce a new version of that character?
To be frank, I mean, I was a huge fan of the character because that run of Justice League that he debuted in was my first book I read ongoing, like start to finish, that Justice League starting in 1997. In the present day, a very obvious white savior character, I think people could do better. And Grant had already planted the seeds, by the way, that Aztec in the future, in the Rock of Ages storyline, was going to be a woman of color. And so I just thought it was a perfect moment to both pay homage to what happened in that run and sort of fill in the blanks and give us a new character. I mean, you know, who is named Aztec and actually is a Zapotec woman. And from there, put her into the DC universe and see who that angers and who that pleases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to tack onto that, I'm curious about Extraño and a character who was kind of a gay Latinx stereotype when he first appeared in the late 80s in New Guardians, but you include him in both the JLA and a Midnighter in Apollo, going by his name Gregorio. And I love what you did with him, but why did you want to bring him back? And what exactly did you do to fix him?
Well, I mean, why would I want to alter his character? I would say should be somewhat, you know, honestly, when I told Dan DiDio what that character was, he was aghast that we had done it 30 years ago. So, you know, he's the first DC Marvel character that was depicted as gay. You know, obviously North Star debuted earlier, but was not out earlier. And so I think Stranio is a historic character, and we need to celebrate that. And that's really why I wanted to bring him back. And I know the funny thing is, based on what we're saying, I brought him back in a way that I thought would sort of be a salve on a lot of the relatively stereotypical or defamatory depictions he's had in the past. And yet, there are creators from South America, like my friend Luciano Vecchio, who are both excited that I brought him back, but push back that I made him, you know, on the surface level, less flamboyant and want to go back to something that they consider more authentic, you know. And so now that he's back in prominence, you know, much like we were saying about Midnighter, I've done what I always try to do what I can, which is to tee things up for creators who actually have that lived experience. And I'm interested to see where he goes next. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't necessarily what I expected.
That's interesting. Yeah, we just I just spoke with Luciano for an upcoming episode, and we did look at his redesign of Extraño for his in his project of redesigning queer characters, and he did give him a little more of a flair. Although I have to say, I thought your version was particularly when Fernando Blanco was drawing it was very hot. But anyway, I guess I wanted to just tack on there with this other sort of idea that you've brought up in other interviews that relates to your Justice League of America run, where you had, you know, Vixen and Ryan Choi, the first, I guess, Asian American version of the Atom. You had the Ray, and you talked about it in the end of the book in terms of evolving the superhero. I'm wondering what you mean by that. Like, what does evolving the superhero mean?
So, you know, a lot of what I hope to do there is inspired by another book I think that is sort of an under-celebrated classic, which is Wildcats 3.0. I don't know if you guys read that.
No, I have the first issue of Wildcats in my house because I got it at the flea market, but I have did not read Wildcats 3.0.
In 1987. No, but like, so Wildcats 3.0, Joe Casey, oftentimes genius, sometimes guy wearing sunglasses inside, wrote this book where Spartan inherits the Halo Corporation from his quote-unquote father and realizes that he can do more to change the world and save the world if he stops having superhero fights and starts innovating. And so the first, like, six issues is just about the fact that Halo has made a never-ending battery and how much that changes the world. And they've made it using, like, a combination of his powers and Void's powers. And that's what I was starting to think about with the Justice Foundation is, you know, we have this default of show up and beat up some villain and protect people, but could these people, these abilities do more? You know, can they truly change the world and arm people themselves, whether it's with health, whether it's with awareness, whether it's intelligence or innovations, and actually protect the future by cementing it in the present and actually giving us new technologies and new medicines and new ways of life that help us more than just showing up and punching Mogul in the face. There should be a Justice League that does that, you know, and that was my hope.
Maybe yeah. We should talk about Martian Manhunter in the home stretch here.
I mean, I just am curious about just your writing style. You have this way of, whether it's mythological terms or sort of alien jargon in Martian Manhunter, you just sort of throw the reader into a universe, kind of like Buckaroo Banzai style. I'm just wondering where that impulse for compression comes from. I'm a big fan, but I'm just curious about that.
It's an ode to a lot of science fiction and fantasy in some ways, you know. Yeah, which often, you know, back in the day did not come with a glossary, which is not to say that's what you're saying, but I'm just. And I also, but it's an illusion of the creators that I love, you know, like I was a Grant Morrison guy. I was a Peter Milligan guy. I love cut-ups. I love just aggressively strange literature like William S. Burroughs. And, you know, I think it's funny. There's more jargon in every issue of Green Lantern that makes no sense than Martian Manhunter. It just and so I know that I'm doing an ode to someone like Grant. And I hope he'd be proud of it. You know, I hope he's reading the book in his castle, which doesn't have the internet, in Scotland. But it's more like the idea as well, I would say, on a thematic level, the fact that this is an alien culture, and I truly believe it should feel alien. I think there's enough there that you can relate, hopefully, but we wanted it to be clear that Mars is not just humans that are green. Like, this is a different culture that lives a different way. And the hope is that you still relate to that, and that, you know, again, hope builds some bridges in your mind.
Now, where did you get the idea? The Martians, I always think of the Spice Girls song, When Two Become One, when the Martians are like making love. Where did you get the idea for that from?
Well, we evolved that actually. A lot of, I mean, everything in Martian Manhunter comes from me and Riley. A lot of it is inspired by taking all the other Martian Manhunter content that's been done and Mars content and sort of eating it and then seeing what we can do about how it tastes. And like, so John Ostrander, who I think did actually a very good Martian Manhunter series with Tom Mandrake back in the 90s, alluded to this. He would show John and Mariah sort of melding their bodies, and Tom Mandrake would do this beautiful shadowy mixture where their faces would mix together and all these things. And so there's a seed of it planted there, and then we took it hopefully many steps farther in the book. But I think John is a genius, actually. You know, he is an ex-theologian that then came in to tackle like the conflict between man and spirituality in the Spectre, and then he came and brought that same sort of wonderful social analysis as Martian Manhunter book. So if there is an inspiration for our Martian Manhunter within DC canon, it is that, and we want to go We want to be more radical. We want to be more creative and innovative everywhere we can. But I love what those guys did. And that specific thing you're asking about, we've extrapolated what they did there for when John and Mariah make love. And then we've never seen a Martian birth. And that sort of once we realized we've shown them have sex, we're like, well, we have to take this further. And that's how you got the budding scene. So, you know.
Yeah. So cute, that baby.
We knew when we made her cute, like Riley had actually just had his daughter, and we were just like, oh man, like, can we save them somehow? Because
right.
They said when this jelly bean melts,
it was sad.
It really was.
Yeah, that was sad. I was sad. Okay, we have one more pressing question about the Martian Manhunter. John's partner, Diane Mead, that's her name. Queer lady cop, faces discrimination on the force. Just wondering about that character. And Johnny had a question about DC characters in general.
Well, it's kind of Batwoman's fault, but there's just so many queer lady cops at DC. We've got Renee Montoya, I think Maggie Sawyer. I'm just wondering where the obsession is coming from.
Well, there's no bisexual lady cops. And the important thing about Mead to me is that, yes, she gets an ultimatum from her boss, but she actually gets an ultimatum from her partner, and it's one that bisexual people get all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen in print before. And so I can't speak to the greater
canon.
To the greater tendency towards queer lady cops, but to me, it's all about story first, and that's the answer. Like, what could we have in Mead that shows her, when she goes through her character journey, eventually shows her that she can forgive John for lying about what's inside him? Well, she's done a similar thing, and that's what it's really about to me. And then it's about the fact that as a bisexual person, I've never seen those discussions depicted in comics before. Ones I have had all the time with my exes about, well, you're not, you know, I wasn't allowed to have a leadership position in my GSA in college because I didn't identify strongly enough, which really meant I wouldn't say that I was just gay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was important to me to put those things on the page. And that's really where that came from, both from the fact that she needs to go through her journey and say, oh, well, you know, it's not that it was right that John lied, but he may have had his reasons. And, you know, as you might expect from the story, they're going to end up inspiring each other, as the book goes on. But they're really on parallel journeys. And I think were she not queer, yeah, I could have written it about her like myself as well, you know, hiding that she was Jewish. But we've seen that more, and we had never seen the sort of bi erasure narrative, at least in a mainstream book. I shouldn't say we've never seen it. Many things have been done better than I will ever do in autobiographical work and things like that. But in a stream DC and Marvel book, it's never been shown before, and that was really important to me.
All right, so very last question, a must ask. You love to post a bodacious gym selfie on Instagram. Do you think that writing or reading superhero comics has influenced any of that body stuff?
The inspiration is that because I'm a writer of superhero comics, if I did not go to the gym, I would never leave my couch. And my doctor had a talk with me 2 years ago where she said I need to get my shit together. I really am only competing against myself, as any of us are, but the real answer is I'm going because I used to be bigger, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that if that's how you want to be, but I had a talk with my doctor and she said I need to make some changes. And more so, I realized when I was like 14, I was like, oh, someday I'm going to be a freelance writer and I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to write and I'll have no excuses not to stay in shape and better myself. And well, I've been a freelance writer for 5 years, and it wasn't until this year I started actually getting my shit together. So because I sat down on like January 1st, I was like, why the fuck are you just not doing this? Like, what are you have no excuses. And so I decided it was finally time to sort of try to be the person I thought I wanted, you know, I could be the ideal version of me when I was a kid. And that's the real answer, along with the fact that most freelancers were so sedentary. If we don't create some sort of structure, you know, there's real boring adult health issues.
Yeah.
To that. So,
yeah. Well,
thank you so much, Steve.
thanks for coming on. You can check out Steve on Instagram. And is there anything else you want to plug coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I have a new LGBTQ plus book announcement at New York City Comic Con in like 4 days. So,
oh boy! Goodness, all right.
Well, we'll keep our ears to the. What do we keep our ears to?
Well, to the Aftershock table. I'll tell you, it's with Aftershock. So,
okay, awesome.
That's where you will keep them. But I'm very, very excited about that. Like a lot of my work, I think it is a beautifully imperfect queer character, and there's, you know, many people thought that about Midnight, or like, it's nice finally that a gay character doesn't have to be perfect. Because, there's more than one of them in a book, you know, so they're not.
That's nice.
But, and so I'm very excited about the story. It wrestles with a lot of things we talked about, masculinity. I mean, I'll tell you, it's a mixed martial arts book. So it definitely wrestles with toxic masculinity and sort of the internal struggle we go through when we come out. But I just like the character dynamics are so fire. It's so tense and awesome. I'm working with an artist I worked on Midnighter with. You'll see which one later in the week. And I'm working with my friend Phil Kennedy Johnson, also a great dude. Not on my list of the five nicest people, but I can only name three. But Phil's amazing, so I can't wait for you guys to see about that.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Wow, it's like a window into this whole other side of the world because we're so focused on fandom.
Yes.
That's our first interview with like a real comic book writer who wrote something that we had pored over with the Midnighter series.
That's true. We fully dissected Steve's work and now we're talking to him.
Mm-hmm. What's some takeaways that you might have?
Well, my biggest takeaway is that Two-Face finally makes sense to me now, because I never understood especially when Batman is on the Justice League, he has like 20 different plans for everything. He's always cool as a cucumber, and he's dealing with these like intergalactic space gods or whoever the Justice League are fighting, something really over the top and reality altering. So Steve sort of put Two-Face is just like a guy with a coin and some guns. So I never understood why Two-Face was ever a threat at all to Batman. And now I understand that it's the personal connection and also probably the entropy that makes him a threat. So that I thought was very revealing to me as a Batman fan.
Well, there we go.
Let's say a big thank you to our sponsor, BearPad. Shop BearPad at bearpad.storeenvy.com. Also, a big thank you to the guys at Linoleum Knife, Dave and Alonzo, for putting out this podcast. You're probably listening to it on Linoleum Knife RSS feed, but if not, check out all of their podcasts. And also check out our Patreon, patreon.com/supergays with a Z, and subscribe so we can keep this show going. Big thank you to some of our sponsors. Especially want to do a shout out to Anna Jones, who just became a sponsor at the $20 level, actually the $25 level. But big thank you to Anna Jones for helping keep this show on the air.
And thanks again to Steve Orlando. You were a good sport, and we really appreciate it. You know, I don't know if you knew how many questions you were going to get, but you got a lot, and you answered them, and we really had a
solid 10, 15 left that we had to chop, so that's how we went into this interview.
Yeah, because we are super gay.
We are super gays. All right.
All right, bye.
Bye. After midnight, gonna let it all hang out. After midnight, gonna juggle all get shout.